morning. I have a few things to talk with you about this morning before we get going. What's that? I don't know what National Day it is. I didn't pick up on that this morning. So first of all, don't forget there's an assignment due Friday, right? A class assignment that's due Friday. That's your fifth of six, so there's only going to be one more after that. It talks about the flu virus. I think you may find that interesting because, you know, the people are worried about the flu virus now and people are getting flu and so forth. Give you a little insight into what that's all about and perhaps how it relates to our immune system. So there's that. Those of you that did not turn in a creative project the first round, remember Thursday is when they're due for this, the second, third material. So I'll be bringing in a cart and so forth, planning on loading up a whole stack full of carts of creative projects on Thursday. So don't forget that little deadline. And I want to talk with you about grading a little bit too. So the second midterm has been scored. The results are out there. The average on that exam was just about spot on the same as the average with the first exam. So it was a C average on that exam. You can go out, you can find out how many questions you got correct on the second exam. Now, it can fool you a little bit because the first exam, remember, had 61 questions. The second exam actually had 59 questions. What I record in my grade book, or what I work with, is not that number that you got, but that number converted to 100 points. So each exam is really worth 100 points. So I'll go ahead and make that conversion. So because there were different numbers of questions, you might look and say, oh, I got a couple points or a couple questions worse than I did on the last exam. And interestingly enough, when I put that all on my spreadsheet, because of the difference in the numbers of questions, those are about the equivalent on a 100-point scale. So anyway, we're collecting these points. Right, 400 points are coming from the exams, including the final exam, which is coming up. And then the other 400 points are coming from the lab. That was 200 points. So hopefully you're all doing really well in lab. And from the class assignments, both in class and out of class. We haven't done a whole lot of in class, but out of class. Assignments, whatever your percent on those is, that's 100 points. And then the creative project. So that's where the rest of those points are coming from. Now, to give you a little boost on the final exam that's coming up, a 200-point exam, here's what I am willing to do again this term. If you are able to score at least 10% better on the final exam compared to your two midterm exams, so I'm looking at the 200 points that you've already got, right, on the two midterm exams, because I've converted all of these things already. And if you can score at least 10% better on the final, on that 200-point scale compared to the two midterms, then I will jettison your two midterm exams and double your final exam score. So you do have an opportunity, if you've been kind of struggling with the exams, you have an opportunity to bring that exam score up. Now, those of you that haven't been struggling, have been moving right along really well with those exams, don't forget that you're already getting the benefit, since I don't give A minuses in this class. If you make it over the A line, you get an A. And so I've kind of benefited you at that end. Now I want to kind of maybe help people at the lower end and give you a little bit of a boost. But you got to score 10% greater on the final than you have on the other two.
Yeah.
Final is double the number of points, double roughly the number of questions, and it is cumulative. So, well, with that, generally the final is something like 60% to 2/3 new material that we haven't had yet, and then the rest looks back on the older material. And that's why I feel kind of comfortable doing that, because I know you've got to review that other material also, and it's a chance to bring your score up a little bit. So keep that in mind as you're studying. I'd really recommend that you be working at that. Even I know that the final's like 3 weeks away or something, actually maybe a little more than that away, but I think by now you've probably realized you can't put it off. You've got to be kind of studying all the way along in order to do well in the class. Yeah.
Do I know who the final is?
Okay, so lots of excitement coming up in these closing days of the class. It always amazes me how quickly we get to this point. For me, the class flies by. I know for some of you it may not fly by so fast, but we're getting there. So, and registration started for next term, right? Pre-registration. So I know you're all thinking about that too. Okay, so any questions, comments, or things before we dive into anything that you've just wanted to say and haven't said it? Oh, maybe those things should be left unsaid. Right? Okay, so I put this review sheet up here because remember the last midterm really didn't cover any of this material. So for those of you that are keeping track of these things, you know, we finished off the immune system by talking about allergies and AIDS. And there will be some questions about those things on the final exam. So make sure that you're kind of you're up on that and you have some idea of what's going on with those two. I want to start talking about the next to last system that we're going to talk about now, and that's the nervous system, communication. Communication within the organism. So that's the next to last. We'll spend a couple days on that, and then we'll spend the rest of our time on the reproductive system at the end. That's what we have left to do. In lab, you're actually, these next three labs are going to all be on reproduction and so forth. So labs are getting a little ahead of us, but we knew that would happen from the very beginning. So you'll be taken care of in lab. So when we think about communication within the body, I've already talked with you about this a bit and so forth. There really, remember, two kinds of communication that happen within the body to coordinate all the events that go on and so forth. The one that we've already talked about so much is hormones. All right, again, remember, hormones tend to be relatively small molecules compared to some others. They're produced in one part of the body by glands and there are certain glands that are responsible for producing a lot of the different hormones. They release those molecules into the blood system that circulate in the blood, and those molecules are targeting different organs or groups of cells or so forth in the body, and they cause some sort of an effect in the body. Now, we really talk quite a bit about one kind of hormone that we might use, and that's the kind that binds to a receptor and causes then a series of events to happen within the cell. So glucagon was an example of that when we looked at maintaining blood sugar level. Binding to a receptor on the outside of the cell, a protein on the outside of the cell, and that causing a whole chain of events to happen. And that's a real general mechanism for certain kinds of hormone action when the hormone action is fairly immediate and not horribly long-lasting, because once that hormone's out of the system, then everything's going to kind of reset and go back. So that's one way that hormones work. The other way that hormones work that I haven't really talked about, and I'm really not going to spend a whole lot of time, I just want to mention it kind of in passing here, is that the hormone will actually get transported into the cell. So it's not staying on the outside of the cell on that receptor. It's getting brought into the cell. It's literally brought into the nucleus, and it affects how the DNA is read. And so it will maybe turn genes on or turn genes off. And we see that a lot, especially in hormones that are involved in developmental processes. As you're born as a baby and you're developing and going through all those stages, a lot of the hormones that are involved in doing that are affecting your DNA and turning genes on and turning genes off and so forth. So they have, those kinds of hormones have much longer lasting effects on the organism than the other kind of hormone that I spoke of. But in general, we always think of hormones, the hormonal system, as being kind of a slow means of communicating within the body, because those hormones have to go through the, they have to circulate through the circulatory system, they have to eventually get to the target organs, bind whatever they're doing, getting things going. So we generally think of them as being slow in uptake, in causing an effect, and the effects that they cause tend to be long-lasting. And now, you know, I just told you that some were more long-lasting than others, so the hormones that are binding the receptors on the outside, that effect is going to continue until that hormone is no longer out there. The hormones that are getting into the nucleus, that effect could continue throughout your whole life or less, depending on what those hormones are. Okay, so that's what I mean in terms of longer lasting in that context. So that's one way that we have of communicating within the body and getting things done. The other way that I've only mentioned from time to time then would be the nervous system. A nervous system is very, very different from the hormones, right? Because with the nervous system, we have cells that are specialized to conduct information very, very rapidly from one point of the body to another. So where the hormone system, no matter how fast it may seem in terms of circulating the hormones around the body, the nervous system is much, much faster. We can conduct information the whole length of the body in milliseconds, in thousands of a seconds, and elicit responses as a result of that, whereas if we were depending upon hormones to do that, it would just take a whole lot longer to do that. So the nervous system gives us a very rapid means of communicating within the body. So that's one big difference between the two. Another difference is that the hormones really tend to target relatively large areas, like they might target a whole organ. We talked about the liver and, again, glucagon, insulin for that matter, reacting that way too, and targeting the cells of an organ and causing them to do something, whereas the nervous system can target very pinpoint areas down to a single cell. That's probably more unusual, but a group of cells, a small group of cells, so can very rapidly target a very small group of cells and cause them to do something. So again, much more rapid, much more precise in what it does, and when the nervous impulse is no longer going down the nerves, then that effect is shut off. Right, so in terms of rapidity, it's rapid to turn on, rapid to turn off, but it gives us a very important way of, again, of controlling things that are going on within the body. Now, generally, we think of the nervous system in terms of controlling the muscular system. So the only reason you can move your skeletal muscles is because you've got nervous impulses that are going down to those skeletal muscles that are triggering them to contract. And so muscle is a real biggie, especially skeletal muscle. Sometimes it's the smooth muscle inside. Smooth muscle is kind of interesting because it depends on the muscle that we're talking about. It will respond either to the nervous system or to the hormonal system. So smooth muscle has a couple of different ways of getting triggers to contract. The skeletal is definitely all nervous in origin. But it's not just moving muscles, it's sensing things around us. It's bringing in information from the environment, whether it's the internal environment or the external environment. It's all those kinds of things that the nervous system does for us that there's no way that anything else could really do for us. So I want to spend some time now looking at the nervous system. And what we're going to focus on isn't so much the way the brain is constructed and what the different areas of the brain are doing and whatnot, which is a whole area of study in itself. I'll leave that to the physiological psychologists to deal with. What we're going to be talking about in here is the nuts and bolts of how this works. What in the world is the nervous impulse? How do we generate a nervous impulse? What kinds of things ultimately might mess up transmission of the nervous impulse, and so forth. So that's kind of the direction that we're going to be heading in this class. So let me start off by saying that when you think of nervous tissue, there are really a couple of different kinds of nervous tissue. One is the conductive tissue, the tissue that's actually able to conduct the information. And the other is supporting cells. There are a lot of supporting cells in the nervous system that are involved in helping to nourish the nerve cells and helping to maintain correct balance in the interstitial fluid around the nerve cells in terms of insulating the nerve cells. So a lot of different kinds of cells that are involved there, but none of those cells conduct information. All those are just support cells for the nervous cells. And what we're going to focus on then are the nervous cells themselves. We call the nervous cells neurons. So we're going to be dealing with these neurons and talking a lot about how a neuron is constructed, what the different kinds of neurons are, how we might hook up some real simple wiring systems for neurons. We have, believe it or not, we have some very, very simple wiring diagrams in our own bodies. Most of them are incredibly complicated, but there's some real simple ones we'll talk about. And then how in the world do these neurons work? How do you, what is that nervous impulse? What's going on with those, and how do they pass it on and on and on and on? How do we see? How do we hear little goodies like that that we may or may not get a chance to spend much time with? Okay? So, neurons. These are the conductive cells. Okay, the conductive cells. Now, if we were to sketch a neuron, here's where it gets a little dicey because I have to sketch something. Neurons have some basic parts to them. Okay, somewhere along the way, we're going to find a region that's kind of expanded like that, and that's called the cell body. And within that cell body, we'll find the nucleus of the cell. Now, going from that cell body is going to be at least one, maybe a lot. There's a lot of variability in these kinds of cells. There's going to be a long process like that. So that's an extension of that cell body that we call the axon. The axon is specialized for rapid conduction of information. So it's kind of like the wire of the wiring diagram that we're going to be talking about. That's what's going to carry the information from point A to point B very rapidly. And these axons can be really short or they can be really long. You have certain cells that are, that stretch from your spinal cord clear down to the very tip of your farthest away toe. Single cell, a single nerve cell, a single neuron, that axon, or the other part of it that we'll talk about, the dendrite, they can be that long. So they can be really, really long cells or really short. So the axon is going to give us that ability to rapidly conduct information. And then that axon always terminates in a little structure that seems to have a plethora of names. My preferred name for that structure is the end plate. That's the end of that axon. That's where that information that's coming down is going to have to cross from that end plate to the next cell. And we'll talk more about that later. So the end plate. The author of your book calls it a synaptic terminal. That's a mouthful. So when you see synaptic terminal in the text, same thing. Other terms that you may find, especially if you're a psychology major or something, you're reading about some of the physiological psychology and stuff, some of the other terminology could be a synaptic Bhutan,
Bouton is just French for button. So sometimes you see them called synaptic buttons. Sometimes they're just called boutons, and on it goes. I mean, there's just everybody seems to have their own idea as to what that end structure should be called. So I will probably be kind of going back and forth between these two terms, end plate and synaptic terminal. Those are one and the same, and I will try to be as consistent as possible in that. But as I said, you may find some of this other terminology out there too. Depending on what you're studying and what you're reading. The end plate is specialized for transmission of that nervous impulse to the next cell. Transmission of that impulse to the next cell. Most end plates are specialized for that. There are a few nerves that I'm just going to mention in passing in a few minutes that secrete hormones. So we saw an example of that when we were talking about water balance in the body. We talked about how in the hypothalamus there were nerves in response to changing water balance in the body. They would secrete more or less of the antidiuretic hormone. They're called neurosecretory nerves, and so their end plates are specialized to release hormones. But if you look at the whole, you know, all of the nerves in the body, they're definitely in the minority. Most of the end plates that we see are going to be trying to pass that information on to the next cell. Rather than secreting or releasing hormones. So we've got the cell body kind of integrates information that's coming in. We've got the axon that is causing that or providing the rapid conduction of that information. Generally, when we draw something like this, we'll draw a little arrow like that, and that little arrow indicates the direction that information is moving. Okay, so down the axon to the end plate, where we're going to either transmit that to the next cell or we're going to secrete hormones, depending on who we are and where we are. Now, the only thing that we're missing here is bringing information in, right? So on this end, somewhere, somehow, we'll find some other processes called dendrites. That are specialized for receiving information. Okay, so this is the end where information is going to come in. If we're dealing with neurons that are bringing in information from the outside world, those dendrites are going to be all specialized to respond to different kinds of stimuli in the outside world. If we're dealing with dendrites that are connected to other nerves and they're just transmitting information along, those dendrites are going to look different. There may be a few different dendrites. There may be a lot. At some point, we're going to have information being fed in. In fact, there are some neurons that don't even have dendrites. The information just gets fed in directly to the cell body. So incredibly variable in their structure and shape and what they look like, these neurons. But those are the four basic areas that you want to be aware of. The dendrites, information coming in, the cell body integrating that information, the axon, rapid conduction of that to the next cell, and then the end plate or synaptic terminal, we're passing that information on. Oh, this is irritating. Well, I spent some time this morning pulling up some pictures of neurons so that I could show you some of the variability, and I managed to not bring it with me. So maybe we'll have to wait until Next time I'll try to remember to bring it, just to give you a feeling for the variability. Sometimes lots of dendrite. There are some nerve cells where the dendritic end is just like branches on a tree. You've got just bazillions of these dendrites, which allow them to make just a tremendous number of connections, interconnections. You find those in the central nervous system, right? Others have very few. The positioning of the cell body, sometimes it's at one end, sometimes it's close to another, because it kind of depends on the nerve. Sometimes, generally, you think of it as being somewhere along here. Sometimes the cell body is just sticking off to the side. Most of the time, it's in the main path. The axons, you may have a single axon. You may have an axon that branches. There may be multiple branches, so that that's feeding information to multiple different cells. So tremendous, tremendous variability in what these things can look like. There's a diagram. If you look in your lab manual in exercise one, as I remember, there's a diagram of some examples of different kinds of neurons when we were looking at those tissues at the very beginning. So you can see some of the variability there too. So just remember, they're highly, highly variable in their structure, but they generally have those basic parts to them. I mean, they've got to have a cell body, an axon, an end plate. It's just, as I said, some of them don't have any dendrites that you can identify. Most of them do, and it may just be a few to a whole bunch of different ones. So that's our basic cell. That's our basic conductive cell of the nervous system. Now, there are different kinds of these neurons, and I just want to list out five for you, because these are the five basic kinds. So let's see, types of neurons. So one type would be what we call sensory neurons. And as I mentioned earlier, these are the neurons that bring information into us. If it weren't for sensory neurons, we wouldn't know what the world around us was like. Right? We have sensory neurons that are specialized to respond to light. The brain integrates that, and that gives us vision. We have sensory neurons that are specialized to respond to sound waves. And brain integrates that, and ultimately we wind up with our hearing. We have sensory neurons that are sensitive to pressure, and those give us a sense of touch. We have sensory neurons that are sensitive to various chemicals in the food that we eat, and it's from those that we get our sense of taste. We have sensory neurons that are sensitive to chemicals in the air around us, and from that we get our sense of smell. So all and these sensory neurons are all very different in their dendrites and what they look like in order to respond to these different kinds of stimuli. I think when we talk about sensory neurons and bringing information into the body, there's one area that we oftentimes forget about. We think, okay, that's going to bring all this information into us. That's how we know about the world around us, is through sensory neurons bringing that information in. And of course, they're going to feed that into the brain, and it's all going to get put together in the brain. But there's another world, so that's the outside world. There's this inner world within our own bodies, and there's sensory neurons that are monitoring that also, in the hypothalamus especially. So it comes back to those nerves that respond to water balance in the body, right? Those, even though we'll identify them as neurosecretory, we'll get to them in a minute, they're performing a sensory function, because they're monitoring the amount of water in the body and deciding whether there's too much or too little or whatever. And in response to that, communicating with an effector. So we talked about neurons that are monitoring the pH of the blood, right? CO2 levels, in order to help control respiration rate. There are neurons that are monitoring blood rate, heartbeat rate, and on and on it goes. So not only are we bringing in sensory information about the outside world, but we're bringing in sensory information from the inside world also. We're just not cognizant of that generally, right? We're cognizant of what's coming in from the outside, but we don't get to see all of the data that's coming in from the inside, which is probably a good thing because it would probably absolutely overwhelm us if we saw that information coming in. Sensory neurons are feeding information into the central nervous system is what they're doing. Okay, so we've got a whole bunch of those, and as I said, they're all going to be unique. They're going to have dendrites that respond to the different stimuli that we bring in. They're all unique in that sense. But they're all going to kind of work the same way, so we'll come back to that. Second kind of neuron is what I call associative. And another term that you'll see used for these is interneurons. So associative neurons. Associative neurons, you can think of like jumper cables. If you want to increase the complexity of your connections, if you want to increase the number of connections that are going in and direct nervous signaling traffic in different directions and so forth, you call upon the associative neurons. They increase the numbers of connections. They send information in various directions. We find a lot of associative neurons in the spinal cord. And in a minute, we'll put together a real simple wiring diagram that involves the spinal cord and involves associative neurons, and you'll see that they're responsible for directing information in a number of different ways, so that not only do we get an action maybe that's needed occurring, but we also are informed in the brain of what's going on and stuff. So think of them as jumper cables. Think of them as neurons that are able to increase the complexity of the connections. They're able to send information in various directions, information that's coming in from the sensory neurons. A third category of neurons that are really important to us are called motor neurons. Motor neurons are responsible for feeding and taking information out of the central nervous system and feeding it to our skeletal muscles. So when you contract a skeletal muscle, it's because you've sent information down a motor neuron or several motor neurons that have targeted a muscle that have triggered that to contract. They've actually made that to contract by sending an electrical impulse down the way. So motor neurons are always connected to skeletal muscle. Motor neurons are interesting because they're one of those that the axons themselves branch into multiple branches. And so motor neurons can actually cause several skeletal muscle fibers to contract at one time. And we'll talk more about that later and how we can get a graded response. You know, why is it that you can be very gentle, you can pick something up without putting much pressure at all? Or you can make that hand squeeze really, really tight. You know, what is it about this whole system that allows us to control how hard our muscles or how many of our muscle fibers are contracting at one time? So we'll talk a little bit about that. But the motor neurons are sending that contraction information down the way. They're causing those skeletal muscles to contract and everything's working properly. Now, you don't always want all of your muscles contracting at one time, right? We'll talk about a reflex arc in a minute. Simple reflex arc where, let's say you're in the kitchen and you've had your stove on and you've taken a pot off and the burner's still hot and you accidentally put your hand on the stove, on the burner, what are you going to do? Leave it there and say, I smell something cooking. Or pull it off really quick, right? You're going to pull it off really quick. And that's what that reflex arc is responsible for. Well, when you're doing that, you don't want your muscles fighting each other. Our muscles tend to be in antagonistic pairs. So when one muscle contracts, the other muscle stretches out. So triceps, biceps, right? You contract your tricep to bring your arm up. Well, you don't want your bicep to be contracting at the same time trying to take your arm down. And so how do we control that? Well, motor neurons are sending that information down to contract, this next category, inhibitory neurons, inhibitory neurons are inhibiting the function of the skeletal muscles. So when you're stimulating one of a pair of antagonistic muscles, you're inhibiting the other, so that you're not going to fight. Now, you can make them fight each other, right? But that, we'll talk more about how that happens. You can override some of this information. But in general, when you're inhibiting one side, when you're stimulating one side, you're inhibiting the other side. So we have these inhibitory neurons that are responsible for doing that. And it's not just in the context of the muscles, the skeletal muscles, but inhibitory neurons are really, really important in the brain and helping to route traffic in the brain. So we'll come back to that later a little bit. Okay, but that's our fourth category of neurons. And then our last category are those ones that I keep talking about, never write their name down, the neurosecretory neurons. So these are the neurons that are going to be responsible for secreting hormones. They are not going to be connected to another cell. They are not going to be sending information off to another cell. They're going to be responsible for secreting hormones. And we have a bunch of different neurosecretory hormones in the body that are monitoring various things and secreting hormones as needed and so forth. Okay, so those are kind of our five basic kinds of neurons that we use to connect up the nervous system and put everything together the way that it's put together. So let's take a look at a real simple wiring diagram now. Okay, how do we hook these things up and how do we make use of them? So the reflex arc is really one of the simplest wiring diagrams that you can imagine. You know, people working in this area, neurologists working in nerve science and so forth, one of the goals is to figure out in the brain, how are all the neurons connected in the brain to give us the sensations that we have? You know, what is consciousness? How does this all work connected together? Well, there was a triumph of sorts, just to let you know where this whole field is. There was a triumph of sorts just a few years ago, not that long ago, where people working with a little worm that's been used a lot for nerve research. I think this little worm has a total of 71 neurons. 71. You know, that's simple. Took years to figure out how that little nerve network of 71 neurons works. Now think about our nervous system that literally has trillions of neurons. It's a pretty substantial problem that people are working on trying to figure this out. But we know a little bit. We can, like reflex arc, we understand reflex arcs and so forth, where we may not understand exactly all of the ins and outs of how vision is created. We can talk about reflex arcs. So let's talk about a real simple kind of a wiring diagram, and then we'll see how at the basic level, how is this actually working. So a reflex arc is basically a sensory neuron that's sensing something in the environment. That sensory neuron, when it's stimulated, is going to run its information into the spinal cord. And then there are going to be associative neurons in the spinal cord that it connects to and that route information. Now, if what we're talking about, let's say we're talking about pain receptors. Okay, so this particular sensory neuron that we're dealing with is a pain receptor. And you're out pounding nails in your fence one bright sunny day like today, and you hit your thumb with a hammer. Okay, what do you do? You try to get your thumb out of harm's way. If you're right, you immediately pull that in. So you've got pain receptors that are being stimulated, they're feeding into the spinal column, and they're now distributing that information. One of the places they're going to distribute that information is to motor neurons, because we need to get that thumb out of harm's way in case that we didn't figure out the first time it was the hammer and we're going down to slam it again, right? So we need to get that out of harm's way. But at the same time, we need to make sure that the opposing muscles aren't preventing that from happening, right? So these associative neurons are going to be connecting with motor neurons, with inhibitory neurons. But it would be nice, your brain wants to know what's going on too, right? So there's a pathway that's going to shoot up to the brain to inform the brain what's going on. Now, if you had to wait, believe me, if you had to wait for your brain to think about, oh my gosh, I just hit my thumb, I need to move my thumb and get it out of the way in case there's more danger coming, that would take a painfully long amount of time. Okay, so these things, so in the reflex arc context, all we're doing is communicating. We're letting the brain know what's going on, but we're not waiting for the brain to tell us what to do. It's a real quick in and out. So what does that look like? So let's just draw the spinal column over here. Okay, so that's the spinal cord. And I'm going to really simplify these neurons now. Most of the time, I probably won't even draw dendrites. Understand that dendrites exist to increase the number of connections, but I'm just going to draw some real simple neurons where it looks like the previous nerve is connecting into the cell body of the next nerve. So I'm taking some liberty there and leaving some things out. So what we've got is a sensory neuron. Its cell body is going to be in the spinal cord, okay, but it's going to have this long projection out, which by definition would be a dendrite, ending in some pain receptors. So these are pain, for our example, pain receptors. And this is our sensory neuron. When they get stimulated, it's going to bring this information in, and it's going to then connect, as I said, with an associative neuron. So there's our sensory neuron. Here's our little associative neuron, just kind of schematically drawn. Now, that associative neuron is going to direct traffic now. It's going to send information in different directions. One place it's going to send it is directly out the motor neuron. So here's our motor neuron that's going to connect with a muscle. And cause that muscle to contract. So that's a motor neuron. This was an associative neuron. Right there. So now we've got that muscle contracting. That muscle's withdrawing that place where the pain was perceived, right? The thumb or whatever it was we hit with the hammer, silly us. But as I said, we really don't want the opposing muscle, so there's going to be an opposing set of muscles here that would cause the reaction to go in the opposite direction, right? So these are our opposing muscles. The opposing muscle is also going to have a motor neuron feeding. Actually, I have a whole bunch of motor neurons. We're just putting in one. Other motor neurons feeding in. So, how do we keep this muscle from contracting when this muscle contracts, which could be a tendency? Well, the associative neuron also connects with a inhibitory neuron, which connects with the motor neuron. So this is inhibitory. Inhibitory neuron, which, and of course we'd have the similar link over here, So that when a message is going down this side to cause that muscle to contract, this side is going to be inhibited, hopefully preventing this muscle from contracting at the same time. So this muscle will be relaxed while this muscle is being contracted. Okay? Now remember I told you this is one of the simplest wiring diagrams, and all of a sudden it's getting really complicated, but that's how they are. So this would be repeated over here in case this were the muscle that needed to be used, so we could keep this muscle relaxed. So that associative neuron, that's what I mean by increasing the number of connections, routing the traffic to different places. So it's routing it here for activity, it's routing it here for relaxation. And then it's also informing the brain what's going on. So that associative neuron is also going to go up the spinal cord, and the brain will be informed of what's happening. Now we know that we can kind of countermand some of these things. I mean, you've seen some of the tough guy things where somebody will hold their hand over a candle flame or something and their tissue's burning, but they're tough, you know, they can hold their hand there. Well, their reflex arcs are saying, get out of there, get out of there. But you can countermand that by putting enough input from the brain in. So what I'm not going to even try to draw into this diagram, because it's already messy enough, is information coming from the brain that's also going to control these motor neurons. And on it goes. But the simple reflex arc is this in and out and inform the brain. Yeah. And they set you up on the table, and he pulls out his little red rubber hammer and starts beating you on the knee. You know what he's doing there? He's checking your spinal cord function. He's checking. So we have other sensory neurons. We have things called stretch receptors all throughout our body that let the body know the state of the muscles and so forth. What he's trying to do when he's got you up on the table, your legs relaxed and so forth, trying to hit right below the kneecap, to hit a tendon there, to pull the kneecap, to pull the stretch receptor, to make you think that your leg has been overstretched down, and then the reaction would be to unstretch it, right, to kick it out. And that's what they're looking for when they set you up there and hit you with the rubber mallet. Is that information getting into the spinal cord and back out again properly or not? And if they find that you don't have that reflex, then why? What's going on? Same thing with the Achilles tendon. They'll do it down there and be looking for a reaction down there too. So they're just trying to make that stretch receptor to set it off and to cause a reaction that's the natural reaction for that. Okay, so very fast in and out. We actually, in lab, we don't do this anymore, but we used to have a lab that we would do where we would time reactions. Some real basic in and out kinds of reactions versus if you have to sit there and think about something, how fast is your reaction time for that? And we would find probably about a 4 or 5 fold difference in reaction times for something where, like if you were just waiting for a light to come on and you press a button, that's really fast kind of in and out stuff. You don't need to process. You don't have to think to yourself, oh, the light's come on, I better press the button, although some people may have. And then we compare that to kind of like a word match thing or something. And when you start to build central nervous system processing into this whole thing, it slows it down really quickly. You can demonstrate that pretty easily. Okay, so that's a simple reflex arc. That would be a good thing to remember as we come to the close of the class and think about the final exam. Any questions about that? Yeah.
Does every single motor neuron that connects to a muscle have an inhibitor neuron?
Okay. They all do. We have to be able to inhibit those results.
Any other?
Okay, let's take our break just a wee bit early here so that when I dig into the next thing, I don't have to stop in the middle of it. And when we get back, we'll start talking about how is this actually working? What's the nervous impulse truly? Okay, I took the liberty during the break to go and get that overhead transparency that I wanted to show you so you can just, you know, see what I was talking about with incredible diversity in the structure of neurons, and it goes way beyond that. That's just a little sampling of the different structures that we might find in neurons. So you don't have to worry about the terminology there or anything. It's just highly, highly variable cells that we're dealing with here. So what I would like to move to, now that we've kind of got this reflex arc down, is just the most basic wiring diagram I think that you can make. It's a very old type of a reaction. It's a very important type of a reaction because, as I said, we do this automatically. We'll inform the brain, but we do this automatically. And it helps to get us out of a lot of trouble, hopefully, with that reflex arc. I want to move on now and talk with you about how nerves actually work. What's going on? What is that nervous impulse? And what's going on? How does that work? So we're over there at the middle of page 58, right? So as you can imagine, people wondered about this for a long, long time. I'm not sure I can make this drawing. Let me try to make a little drawing here. So a lot of the early work was done with squid. Believe it or not, squids have some what are called giant axons. They're very long, very large neurons, or the axons of the neurons. A lot of work was done with that. A lot of the early work was done with frogs, poor little frogs, because you could make such a great preparation out of them. Where they would use the calf muscle. It's called the gastrocnemius muscle. They'd use the calf muscle, and you can dissect a frog, dissect that out. You can retain the sciatic nerve, which feeds down in there, which causes the muscle to contract. So they got used and abused a lot, especially since, anyway. So if you were to take, let's say... Okay, so this is going to be, we're going to make a clamp here, and if you were to clamp the frog muscle in, and generally what people would do is leave it attached at one end to the bone. So you have a little piece of bone and sticking in here, and you've now got your gastrocnemius muscle here. Okay, so that's the muscle, and then you attach a little weight to it. The purpose of that weight is just to keep the muscle stretched out so that, because you don't have the opposing muscle here, you want to keep that muscle stretched out unless the muscle is contracting. Okay, and then hanging out up here, that is the sciatic nerve. Okay, the nerve that's feeding in. Sciatic nerve there, this is the calf muscle. I was out looking on YouTube yesterday trying to find where somebody would have actually posted something like this, because I thought, well, for sure somebody's got something like this out there, and I couldn't find anything. I couldn't believe it, except for some things I didn't want. So anyway, you get the drawings. You get the benefit of the drawings. So normally this is stretched out, right? The muscle stretched out. What was known is with something like this, if you would come up to this nerve, so there's the nerve, if you come up to that nerve and pinch it, you could get that muscle to contract. So if you had some of the old equipment they used to use, there's a thing called a chymograph. There's a big drum, you can imagine, a big drum, and it would get smoked. They'd smoke it with soot, and then you could use that to inscribe a line. So this drum would be spinning around, and if you hooked a little pointer or something to this, when that muscle contracted, it would go up. Right, so you could record that on the chymograph. You see, oh, look, there's the contraction because the muscle went up, and then when it relaxed, it went back down, up and down, up and down. So you could record these kinds of things. So you're going to have to just kind of, you're going to have to imagine what's going on here. So when you pinch the nerve fairly quickly, the muscle contracts, this whole thing will go up, and then once you quit pinching it, then it's going to relax, and the weight's going to pull it back down again. That's the preparation. So as the story goes, there was a physiologist a number of years ago that was working on a system like this. I always imagined that he was in some dark castle in Transylvania somewhere. He was working on a preparation like this during a thunderstorm. Okay. And he noticed that every time lightning struck, the muscle would contract. It would pull it up, and then it would relax again. Every time the lightning struck with enough, close enough, and so forth. So that was kind of one of the first hints that there might be something electrical going on. So we knew that you could pinch it and get a reaction, but now we're starting to see that electrical activity might be involved. Well, it didn't take long before people with their various kinds of devices that they had in those days, and this was a long time ago, with static electricity and so forth, could begin to demonstrate that if you applied an electrical impulse to the nerve, that would cause the calf muscle to contract, just like pinching the nerve would cause the calf muscle to contract. So people began to look at this, they go, maybe it's some sort of electrical activity, because certainly, you don't have anything pinching the nerves to make the muscles contract normally. So maybe it's some sort of electrical activity, and so people took off with that, with progressively better and better equipment and so forth, trying to document whether indeed electrical activity was responsible for causing the contraction or going down the length of the nerve and causing the contraction of the muscle. So what they saw first are these what we call extracellular recordings. Over on page 59, we're going to come back to page 58, but over on page 59, I want you to take a look at this series of diagrams. What they did was to take a nerve. Okay, so we've got, say this is the sciatic nerve, but just kind of for point of reference, let's suppose we're dealing with a single neuron here. Maybe this is the squid giant neuron or something, and this is kind of our idealized, stripped down nerve, right? And so there's the cell body, there's the nucleus, and the kind of equipment that they had in that day, they could had some fairly decent voltmeters. So if it's electrical, you think, well, maybe we can see a voltage going down the length of the nerve. So they would take the voltmeter and put the two probes of the voltmeter, so that's our voltmeter, they put the two probes on the outside of the nerve, okay, to see if they could see anything going on. If the idea was that if it's an electrical impulse that's traveling down the length, maybe we'd be able to see it that way. The electrodes, the probes that they were using, weren't sophisticated enough that they could do anything else. If they tried to stick the probe inside the nerve, they would destroy the nerve. Okay, so this is pretty unsophisticated equipment, and that's why it's called an extracellular recording, because it's outside the cell. Okay, extracellular means outside the cell. So an extracellular recording. Now, what you've got on that diagram is kind of the time lapse of what they can see. They would see one particular kind of a thing. We'll look at it this way. So here we've got the neuron. It's connected to a muscle. The muscle's relaxed. We can
we'll use the muscle to know if indeed a nervous impulse has traveled down the length. Because if it has, then that muscle is going to contract. So we're looking for that. And so this is what they found. At time zero, we haven't done anything yet. The voltmeter is just going to read zero. It's not showing any difference. What we're doing is we're measuring a difference between these two areas, and we're not seeing any difference, which is what you'd expect. They come along and stimulate the nerve, and they stimulate it by pinching it, really. So a pinch, knowing that if they pinched it at one end, eventually that muscle would contract as that whatever it was, the nerve impulse travel down the leg. So they pinch it. So time one, we pinch, nothing. Time two, so a little bit later, just a little bit later, all of a sudden they saw a difference in voltage between the two probes. And then at time three, a little bit later, it would be back to neutral again. There'd be nothing showing up. Time four, a little bit later yet, now we've seen the voltage change crossing this area. And we see a different voltage, a swing of the voltmeter. We know that it's crossing a different area. And a little bit later, then nothing, and then ultimately the muscle contracts. So it's like this packet of something, whatever it was, a packet of electrical energy was traveling down the length of the neuron from the time it was pinched. It was the pinch that started it on its way, and then when it got down to the end, it caused the muscle to contract. That's what they were seeing. So we kind of colored this in like a little pack of voltage that was moving. And because of the way the voltmeters were deflecting, people thought that it was a negative voltage that was moving down the length. And so they called this the wave of negativity. So in the literature you see, oh, there's this wave of negativity that's stimulated by the pinch and moves down the length of the neuron at a particular rate. And then finally it gets to the muscle and it causes the muscle to contract. Okay, wave of negativity. That was one of the first observations, kind of giving us some clues as to what in the world was going on here. Well, it turned out that even though their observations were correct, their conclusions were wrong. I'll tell you why in a few minutes. But as time marched on, the researchers got better at making their little electrodes that they were using. And the people that are doing this kind of research today, what they'll do is they'll take a real fine capillary tube. You might remember, just way back in Biology 101 when we did the water lab, we had those little tiny tubes that we were looking, how high would the water go in the tube? That's a capillary tube. What they'll do to make these electrodes is they'll take those little fine capillary tubes, they'll heat them up in a flame, and they'll pull them out really quickly. And that produces a really, really fine point that they could now stick into the axon without destroying the axon, without damaging it, and start to monitor what's going on across the membrane rather than what's going on outside of the membrane. So our next set of recordings that we're going to look at here are intracellular recordings. And they're made with one probe on the outside hooked up to our voltmeter, but the second probe now is stuck down into the inside of the cell. And we need to go back to page 58 now. Because when people started doing this, they were immediately struck with an observation. Now, you think, remember back here, when we were looking at the outside, this voltmeter wasn't reading any kind of voltage difference or anything until that wave of negativity passed by. And as that wave of negativity passed by, the core that activity is, you can see that there's something going on, but then ordinarily it was neutral, nothing was going on. As soon as people hooked this system up, they discovered that there was actually a voltage difference between the inside of the cell and the outside of the cell.
And so you've got that graph there. What they were seeing is something like this. And we're just measuring millivolts. So these are really small voltages, okay? So really, doing a lot of this stuff waited on the development of equipment that could actually give us the readings that we're seeing. So there's plus 2040 millivolts, minus 2040 millivolts, and you've got all your equipment hooked in, and as you penetrate that electrode down into that axon, you see that immediately there's a voltage difference. Okay, and the inside of the cell is at about minus 70 millivolts compared to the outside. So the what that means is that the inside of the cell is more negative than the outside of the cell, which was kind of a surprising difference. That's a potential difference. We're seeing that. So you can just, over time, this is time, you can see that in that kind of recording, that intracellular recording. What was really surprising is when people took this system and thought, gee, I wonder, okay, so that's what it's like in a nerve cell. I wonder what it's like in a skin cell, or I wonder what it's like in a cheek cell, or on and on and on. And what we find is that almost without fail, when we do an intracellular recording of those cells, and these are not cells that are conducting information at all, right? We always find this kind of a difference between the inside of the cell and the outside of the cell. And so it came to be called the membrane potential. Membrane potential, a difference in voltage between the inside and the out. The inside of the cell is more negative than the outside of the cell. So people, of course, got really curious, like, what in the world is going on? What is causing that to happen? And so if you analyze a cell, you find some interesting things out. So let's just take, let's take an axon and just kind of cut it in half and look at it. You know, it's like a like you're taking a soda straw and cutting it off and looking into the straw. So here's our axon. This could be any. This could be a cheek cell, I suppose. It could be about anything. There's our cross section of a cell. What they found was this: that inside the cell, there are a lot of negatively charged molecules, big molecules, molecules that can't move back and forth across the membrane. We're talking proteins, we're talking nucleic acids and things like that. A lot of big negatively charged molecules that we can just abbreviate with the letter A with a minus. Okay, so A minus equals proteins, nucleic acids, and so on. So a lot of these things that are stuck on the inside of the cell, we don't have those things on the outside of the cell. Hopefully we don't have them. We don't want the protein out there. We don't want the nucleic acids out there, right? They also found some chloride ions on the inside. But here's what was really kind of surprising, is that there was a lot of potassium on the inside. Now, potassium, you may remember, has a plus one charge, the potassium ion. Abbreviation for potassium is K. So a lot of K plus on the inside, but not nearly so much potassium on the outside. So I'm kind of using the size of the letter here to indicate the amount of that substance that we have on the inside or the outside. So a lot of potassium on the inside, not a whole lot on the outside. And the other thing they found was that whereas there's a little sodium on the inside, there's a lot of sodium on the outside. So kind of reversed. And then there's more chloride on the outside. So just kind of a quick and dirty scan of the different ions that there are. That's where we're coming up with this voltage difference. Now, say, okay, what's causing this difference? Why is there so much potassium on the inside? Why is there so much sodium on the outside? All cells have in their membrane a protein called the sodium-potassium pump. Okay, that's a protein that is going to move potassium into the cell, and it's going to move sodium out of the cell. It doesn't do it in equal numbers. It's either three potassiums in for two sodiums out, or the other way around. It doesn't matter. But it's doing this. It's a protein that's pumping these things in and out. Now, think back to biology 101. If we're pumping something against its diffusion gradient, because we're taking potassium that's already low on the outside and we're pumping it in, we're taking sodium that's already low on the inside and pumping it out. If we're pumping something against its diffusion gradient, what do we have an abundant supply of to make that happen? ATP, energy. This takes a lot of energy. And in fact, we'll see that the nervous impulse itself doesn't really take any energy. What takes energy associated with the nervous impulse is maintaining these proper ion balances, is pumping the potassium in, pumping the sodium out. So the sodium-potassium pump is an example of active transport, and it uses lots of energy. It uses lots of energy to accomplish that. So we find that in all cells, and don't even ask the question, why do we find it in cells that aren't electrically active? Because I don't have an answer for that, but we find it in all cells. But ordinarily, you would expect that the way these things can move, that they would kind of equilibrate. You know, you'd get as much positive as negative on the inside, so that would be kind of neutral, and as much positive and negative on the outside, especially because chloride can move back and forth to kind of balance off some of those things. It turns out, though, that once the sodium is kicked out, it's out. It can't get back in, except for certain circumstances that we'll talk about with the nervous impulse. So once the sodium is out, it's out. Once the potassium is in, it's in. But there are some other proteins in the membrane that allow the potassium to leak out. And enough potassium leaks out so that we have a more negative charge on the inside than the outside. Enough potassium leaks out to give us that 70 millivolt difference between the inside and the outside. So to the first approximation, the membrane potential is due to the leakage of potassium out of the cells. So the potassium is leaking out. That leaves more of the negative charge on the inside, more of the positive charge on the outside. And this is all relative. So we're seeing that the inside has that minus 70 millivolts compared to the outside. That's the membrane potential. That's what we find in every cell in the body. Okay, any questions about that so far? The potassium and the sodium, they're in our diets. Remember, in the kidney, we were trying to conserve those kinds of things and so forth. So we really work at conserving those things in our bodies. But they come from our diets. Okay, now, so all cells are like that. So that we haven't solved anything with respect to the nerve cells yet, right? But
Here's the secret of the nerve cells.
The nerve cells, actually any electrically excitable cell, and we'll see, muscle cells are electrically excitable, nerve cells are electrically excitable, so they all kind of fit into this bag. The electrically excitable cells have additional proteins in their membrane that we call ion gates. So let me write this down. Yeah, I'm a, well, okay, yeah, we're there in the middle of page 60. That's where we're at now. Electrically excitable cells have ion gates. Ion gates. And these ion gates, they're proteins. And there's one ion gate for sodium and one ion gate for potassium.
When the gates open, then that sodium or potassium, depending on which gate has been opened, will flow according to its diffusion gradient.
So in other words, if something happens that allows the sodium gate to open, then sodium is going to do what? It's going to rush into the cell. If something happens that allows the potassium gate to open, then potassium is going to rush out of the cell because there's a lot more potassium in the cell than there is outside. Okay, so we have these ion gates. One for sodium and one for potassium. And it's actually the rapid opening and closing of these ion gates that generates the nervous impulse, as we'll see in just a second. So as with the nervous impulse, we get some sodium that rushes in, we get some potassium that rushes out. And once that nervous impulse is passed, then the sodium-potassium pump has to clean up the mess that was left behind. So that's where the energy gets used, is to reestablish those levels. Now, these ion gates are voltage sensitive. Which means that they're going to open in response to changes in voltage across the cell membrane. So the resting potential, the membrane potential, was minus 70 millivolts, right? Neither of those ion gates is going to open at minus 70 millivolts. But if something happens to cause that cell to lose some of that voltage or depolarize, so let me draw this out again. So here's our 0, 20, 40, minus 20, minus 40, minus 60, minus 80. So here's our membrane potential. This is polarity, okay? We call this polarity. And the polarity across that membrane is minus 70 millivolts. If something happens where the polarity is lessened, okay, so that would be going up like that. Then that's depolarity or depolarization. We reckon we talked about the heart, the wave of depolarization. That's what was going on in the heart muscle tissue too. So this is depolarization. That's happening here. So we're losing our polarity. And what will happen is if something happens, so we get to minus 50 millivolts, the sodium gates will pop open. So at about 50, at about minus 50 millivolts, sodium gates. Pop open. Now let's go back here real quick. If the sodium gates pop open, what's the sodium gonna do? Which way is it going to move? It's going to go in, right? No, it's the other way. It's going to go in. And so what's going to happen to the charge in across the membrane? So all of a sudden we've got all this positive, all these positive ions coming in. So what will happen is that charge is actually going to negate the negative, and in fact it'll overshoot to about maybe minus 40 millivolts. Plus minus 40, because the sodium's rushing in. Well, the sodium gates are open for the tiniest, tiniest bit of time. Okay, they're open long enough to allow enough sodium to come in to cause this change in membrane potential. And as that membrane potential changes from negative to positive, it causes the potassium gates to pop open. Now, if the potassium gates pop open, which way is potassium going to move? I'm not going to go back up there. It's going to move out, right? Because there's more potassium inside than outside. So as that potassium then is taking positive charge out, and we're still monitoring this, we'll see that all of a sudden this starts to go back down again. And it tends to overshoot a little bit, and then we'll kind of reestablish. So at switch from negative to positive, the potassium gates pop open.
They're going to repolarize, right, exactly. You're going to reestablish that polarity, and now we're back to the membrane potential. And since this,
So this is the nervous impulse right here. This is what we measured on that original wave of negativity, and I'll explain that to you probably next time. Okay, but that's the nervous impulse that we see. It's the movement of these ions. So the sodium gates popping open, allowing the sodium to rush in, closing, the potassium gates popping open, allowing the potassium to rush out, and then reestablishing that polarity that we had before. This is a very active thing that's going on, and so the term that's been applied to this particular event is called an action potential. So that's the proper name for that. And if we go back over here and look at this, what we were seeing moving down the link there was an action potential. Okay, and I didn't have a handle on it then. Back to that, this action potential that was moving down that they saw arrive at the two probes and so forth. Because this is the level, this membrane potential that we see is the level when that nerve is at rest rather than active. So this is what's happening when it's active, because it's at rest. Rather than calling this a membrane potential like they do for every other kind of cell, you'll see it referred to as a resting potential. A resting potential. So when the nerve is at rest, this is the potential that we see. When the nerve's been stimulated, this is the nervous activity that we're going to see that moves down the length of the nerve. Questions? Are your brains full? I'm going to stop there, and we'll pick up with this next time. Okay.